the challenge of the greatest century of missions. We want to be inspired by examples of excellence as we seek to put feet to our faith in the Great Commission course. My doctoral thesis was on the greatest century of missions. What inspired the greatest century of missions, 19th century missionary movement, the greatest century of Christian advance? The inspiring lives of 19th century missionaries refute the anti-Christian propaganda predominant today. Educational institutions and many governments around the world are enamored with Islam and other Eastern religions. From so many sides, we are being bombarded with guilt manipulation and disinformation and anti-Christian bias. But facts are stubborn things. And the inspiring lives and the incredible achievements against all odds by bold and brave missionaries of the 19th century expose the fallacies and the fraud of these malicious and ignorant assertions. Isaiah 5 verse 20 to 21 says, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight." We're living in an age of arrogance, pride, and where people are in apostasy and proud of their ignorance and arrogant towards God and who are wise in their own eyes. But the greatest century of missions exposes the reality of heathenism which confronted these pioneers of the gospel. It kicks the legs out from under these Marxist myths that slander the saints and seek to rewrite history. The spectacular achievements of God-fearing Christians in confronting cannibalism and child sacrifice and widow burning and slavery needs to be understood. The missionaries of the 19th century steadfastly resisted the Islamic slave trade and set many tens of thousands of captives free. We need to make these eye-opening exposés of what Africa and the Middle East and Asia were really like before the advent of the gospel really known. If people could understand the context, they would be amazed and impressed and want to return to the scriptures which inspired these people. And how much we are indebted to the sacrificial services of those dedicated disciples who laid down their lives, laying solid foundations for the future. When pioneer missionary to Persia, Henry Martin, sought to present his Persian New Testament to the Shah, he was challenged with an ultimatum to declare that Muhammad is the prophet of God. And Henry Martin boldly refused, and he asserted instead that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. His opponents were enraged, and they threatened to have his tongue torn out for blasphemy. When Robert Moffat first applied to the London Missionary Society, he was rejected. His proposal to marry Mary Smith was also refused by her parents. Yet Robert persevered, and on his first missionary expedition to South Africa, he succeeded in bringing to Christ the most notorious bandit and murderer in the country. Finally, Mary Smith's parents relented and gave permission for them to marry, and she sailed to South Africa where they married, and for the next 50 years, the Moffats became one of the greatest husband-wife mission teams in missionary history. Robert Moffat succeeded in being the first to translate the complete Bible into an African language, the Tswana language. This is the church he built. I took this picture at Kuruman, Northern Cape. And this is the printing press, the first printing press north of the Orange River. And on this printing press, the first complete Bible in African language, the Tswana Bible, was printed, as well as Pilgrim's Progress in Tswana, hymn books, catechisms, and much more. This was Robert Moffat's pulpit. His church could easily accommodate 800 people. As you look at the list of missionaries who served at London Missionary Society, LMS Kuruman, you notice David Livingstone is one of those. This was his first mission base where he started out. And Robert Moffat himself undertook some impressive missionary journeys, including multiple to what became Southern Rhodesia, and today Zimbabwe, to Matabeleland. And Robert Moffat became a friend of Lubengula and Mzilikazi and was the first to share the gospel amongst the Matabele. When Great Britain was the greatest economic and military power in the world, Queen Victoria was asked by a visiting African prince what the secret of England's greatness was. Queen Victoria presented him with a Bible, saying, "Here is the secret of England's greatness." And I think that also is the secret of why England is no longer great, because they've forsaken the Bible and have turned from Christ. Christ made them great when they honored his word, and they have thrown God overboard in their schools and the government and their laws, and as a result, they're suffering the inevitable consequences. But the cathedrals stand as a testimony to the greatness that was inspired by the scriptures. As Jesus said, if the children don't cry out, the stones will cry out. And I think today the stones in England, the cathedrals, cry out of a country and a continent that once was made great by the gospel, but which has forsaken it and needs the gospel to be re-proclaimed to them. Samuel Zwemer chose to oppose Islam, and he resolved to engage the enemy on the soil of Arabia, the birthplace of Muhammad, one of the greatest missionaries to Muslims ever, Samuel Zwemer. We have a chapter on him in the Greatest Century of Missions book as well. If we want the 21st century, in which we are, to be the greatest century of missions and revival, then we will need to learn from the Christian pioneers whom God used to make the 19th century. Just to remind people what 19th century is, that's 1801 to 1900, the greatest century of Christian advance so far. I'm not one of those who just looks at the past as the best. I believe we learn from the past to make a much better future. In 1801, the beginning of the 19th century, Protestant Christianity was concentrated in Europe and North America. And except for some small Christian enclaves, Asia was almost untouched by the gospel. There were significant Christian communities in Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan, and a small number of Dutch settlers at the southernmost tip of Africa, but otherwise Africa was mostly unevangelized. However, by the end of the 1800s, Christianity was a world religion, with churches established in almost every country on earth. How Christianity came to become the first truly international religion in just one century is an amazing story. What inspired these incredibly effective missionary pioneers and the successful strategies that they used needs to be prayerfully examined if we are to be more effective in world evangelism. While the 20th century can boast greater numbers of missionaries in the field and larger numbers of converts, the 19th century saw far greater depth of impact for the gospel, especially when we consider the very limited resources available to these pioneers and the overwhelming difficulties and dangers and obstacles which they had to overcome. The missionary pioneers of the 19th century clearly present the most inspiring examples of Christian courage and perseverance against all odds. The incredible adventures of these soul winners, these nation builders, these culture transformers, makes for exhilarating reading. The exploits and the achievements of these extraordinary Christian heroes and heroines have mostly been forgotten in the countries where they were sent out from. For this reason, it's perhaps appropriate that this book, celebrating some of the sacrifices and achievements and adventures of these missionary pioneers, comes from Africa. Because it's we in Africa who have benefited so greatly from the 19th century missionary movement. In this time of secularism and skepticism, some may be surprised to hear how these missionary pioneers are honored in Africa. Dr. David Livingstone, for example, has two towns named after him, Livingstone in Zambia and Livingstonia in Malawi. When I was last in Zambia at Livingstone, I saw 15 monuments to David Livingstone in that one town, and some were new, and they're still building new monuments to him. Other towns in Africa, which were named after Europeans such as Stanleyville, Salisbury, Elizabethville, Fort Victoria, they've had their names changed. But Livingstone and Livingstonia remain as a tribute to a man who brought faith to the hearts of the Africans and fear to the hearts of the slave traders. Livingstone is known as a true liberator in Africa. One of the books we have of David Livingstone is Livingstone, the liberator, known as the best friend Africa ever had. Similarly, while statues to colonial figures like Cecil John Rhodes have been removed, statues and monuments to missionary pioneers like David Livingstone retain their prominence and reflect the deep respect which Africans still have for these Christian pioneers. In fact, some years ago, we did a survey amongst our readers across Africa, who's the greatest African of all time? And while, as you would expect, Shaka Zulu and Cleopatra were on the list and many others, but interestingly, David Livingstone got the most votes. He was voted by readers of Frontline across Africa as the greatest African of all time. Best friend Africa ever had, as one person put it. There have, of course, been many concerted attempts to discredit the memory of the early missionaries. Karl Marx, who I wouldn't normally quote because he's a hideous Marxist, Satanist, atheist, enemy of the gospel, but he declared the first battlefield is the rewriting of history. And have his disciples ever been busy rewriting history? From the time I was first converted in April 1977, I've heard the most vicious slanders against the 19th century missionary movement at missions conferences. At one of the very first missions conferences I ever attended, a missiology professor from Stellenbosch University, Dominie Nico Smit, declared, "The missionaries did not believe that black people had souls. They taught that Africans were the firewood of hell." Now, at the time, as a new convert, I didn't know very much about anything. But what he said sounded so outrageous, so self-contradictory, that I actually stood up in a plenary session of this missions conference, which was actually held at Krugersdorp, the first frontier mission, a student consultation frontier missions. And I challenged him. You know, I was probably one of the youngest people there and least experienced of all. And here I'm challenging a missiology professor for the Stellenbosch, but I just couldn't stay seated. It was just so outrageous. I said, "Which missionaries taught this? Did David Livingstone or Robert Moffat teach us?" And Nicholas Smith looked surprised. I said, "No, not them." I said, "Did C.T. Studd believe these things? Did Mary Slessor believe these things?" He began to look uncomfortable and said, no, not them. I said, "Well, which missionaries believed and taught these things? Because I don't understand why anyone would come to Africa as a missionary, many of them dying of disease here in the field," could have added, "within months. Average life expectancy of a missionary to West Africa was 2 years. Many dying in the field, if they did not believe that the people of Africa were souls for whom Christ died, why would they have come? Didn't many of the missionaries die bringing the gospel to Africa? Why would they have done that?" Here's, by the way, the tomb of Mary Livingstone. Once Mary Moffat, David Livingstone's wife, Mary Moffat's, that's Robert Moffat's daughter, buried in Zambezia province in Mozambique. Why did they come if they believed the people who were ministering among didn't have souls? Honestly. Dominie Nico Smit never answered my question. Instead, he drifted off into some heartless anecdotes about some church members who had bad relations with people of other race. What did that have to do with the missionaries in the 19th century? I wondered why he had picked on these missionaries of other centuries who had opened up Africa for the gospel at the cost of their own lives. I didn't know much about God's law at that time, but I had the uncomfortable feeling that I'd just heard someone bearing false witness against Christians from another era who weren't present to be able to answer the slander. It seems cowardly to make a football out of our spiritual fathers. And by the way, it's easy to score goals if the other team's not on the field. It's no challenge, is it? You can kick the ball into the net over and over and over and say, "Yeah, you know, I won." Well, the other team wasn't on the field to oppose you. It's easy to score goals when the other team's not on the field. I've always been interested in history, and when I was converted to Christ in 1977, I was overwhelmed with a conviction that I was called to missions. I've never doubted that in the last 44 years. And so I've always been something of a bookworm, so I naturally tended to gravitate towards history books. And as my knowledge of missionary history increased, I was astounded at the general ignorance of the church concerning our heritage. I was also very disappointed at the tendency of so many speakers at so many missions conferences to disparage the missionary pioneers who had laid the foundations of the church in Africa. I have been to innumerable missions conferences, some of the biggest ever, like the CAWI, Global Consultation on Frontier Missions, 1997, in Pretoria. 4,000 people at this conference. What's the first item on the agenda? A stupid, mindless, brainless skit, which would have been embarrassing for a youth group, let alone a major missions conference, denigrating David Livingstone as an imbecile. I thought, you know, why don't we all go home? I mean, if Livingstone was a failure, then what hope do any of the rest of us have? Really intrigued. But this at a missions conference, the amount of speakers who'd denigrate and attack and just advertise the ignorance, but sadly, most of the conference attendees would probably be just as ignorant on missions history. And so the amount of bearing false witness against our spiritual forefathers continues to astound me, and I've heard this is the worst at missions conferences and often at missiology departments and universities. I could not help wondering if these speakers really thought that we would have done a better job had we been in their positions. With the few resources they had, facing the overwhelming obstacles and dangers which these missionaries confronted, would we have even ventured into the field? Hindsight is all very well, but pioneers do not have the advantage of the hindsight of anyone who's gone before, because they're the pathfinders. As I've ventured into the mission fields of Mozambique and Angola and Sudan, my respect for these missionaries has only increased. I was reading Livingstone's travels while I was retracing many of his steps in the Shiri Valley of Malawi and the Zambezi Valley of Mozambique in the mid-1980s when I was doing research for the Killing Fields of Mozambique book. In 1989, when I was captured by communist troops in Mozambique and flown by Russian pilots in Soviet MI-8 HIP helicopters to Tet, I was intrigued to see how Livingstone's description of Tet back in the 1850s as being the haunt of slave traders with burned out fields and bodies floating down the river and the reign of terror being created. And I thought that could so easily have been applied to Tet in 1989 under communists as well. The devastation for the Arab slave traders, which he recorded in his Zambezi expedition of 1858 to 1864, could have described a lot of the scorched earth campaign of the communist Frelimo government and his Soviet allies in the 1980s. On another occasion, as I was going down some of the worst roads I've ever experienced in the Shisheki area, I remembered some of the trials and tribulations of David Livingstone in that very area. As I've had to regularly remind volunteers on our mission who complain about the bad roads, we drive where Livingstone walked. And he had to walk across Africa that had no roads, no bridges, no shops, no hospitals, neither was clean water available. As Livingstone reported after his first missionary journey, I've drunk water swarming with insects, thick with mud, putrid with rhinoceros urine and buffalo dung. Hacking his way through dense rainforests, walking for days in pouring rain, totally drenched with his equipment either rusting or rotting, Livingstone persevered across the continent. Hostile tribes demanded exorbitant payment for crossing their territory. His life was often in danger from Muslim slave raiders. He was mauled by a lion, charged by rhino, laid low with fever on over 60 occasions. The afflictions which David Livingstone was called to endure while opening up Africa for the gospel and opposing the Islamic slave trade tested the limits of human endurance. Leeches, maggots, putty fly, cholera, pneumonia, sunburn, huge sores, tropical ulcers, and malaria plagued him. Yet his indomitable spirit rose as he set his heart to accomplish goals which seemed humanly impossible. He persevered, and as a result of his sacrificial labors, the slave trade in Central and Eastern Africa was exposed and eradicated. And Livingstone's steadfast example was used by the Lord to inspire many hundreds of thousands of men and women to devote their lives to African missions. Mary Slessor, for example, went to Calabar, present-day Nigeria. Dr. Kenneth Fraser was inspired to go to Moreland in South Sudan, which has been our primary base of operation for our work in Sudan over the last 26 years. the Moro people have been in the very forefront, the front line of the battle for faith and freedom, bombed by the Arabs, suffering scorched earth. I've ministered at least 1,200 times in South Sudan and Nub Mountains. I've never ministered in a church or a school that hadn't been bombed at least multiple times. Over and over, conferences held in the forest because their churches were being bombed in town. Amongst these people, yet we found the faith strong because Kenneth Fraser planted a strong, powerful church deeply rooted in the Word of God. And so, even today, despite having faced the brunt of the Islamic scorched earth campaigns, you see amongst the people in South Sudan resilience and steadfastness, even under fire, which I saw dramatically when I presented them the first Bible in the Moro language. Within just a short distance of where the Bible translator lay buried after being killed in an ambush with the Arabs. And we were bombed on Sunday morning when we were delivering these Bibles to the people in the community where the Bible translator, Canon Ezra Awiri, lay buried. And yet, after the bombing, the people continued in the church service. We continued with the 5-hour churches. We didn't lose people, we gained people. More people attended after the church was bombed than before. Where in the world did you find churches continuing their church service after experiencing an aerial bombardment? It didn't stop them, did not derail them, because of the solid foundations laid by Kenneth Fraser, who was inspired by David Livingston to go into the field to plant the gospel so well with a strong reformed faith that puts doctrinal steel in your backbone and Holy Spirit fire in your bellies. So that even today you can see, generations later, strong, dedicated, passionate Christians, enthusiastic for the gospel, continuing the work of the Lord in South Sudan. Jesus Christ said, "I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." Jesus Christ is building his church, and all the powers of hell cannot destroy it. But modern detractors of the 19th century missionary movement like to brush aside the historic realities which the missionaries had to confront, and they prefer to paint Africa before the influence of the gospel as idyllic and utopian. For example, Kenneth Gunda, who's just gone to meet his maker, one-time dictator of Zambia, for 27 years, the dictator of Zambia, one-party state, he wrote in his book, A Humanist in Africa, that the people of Africa knew nothing about suffering until the missionaries arrived. Such a shame. His parents, Reverend David Koenda, was very respected. His parents were dedicated Presbyterian servants of the Lord, missionaries. His father, Reverend David Koenda, was trained at Livingstonia, and the members of the Church Central African Presbyterian. Kenneth Koenda said, "I could never accept the Calvinist convictions of my parents. They believe in the depravity of man. I believe in the goodness of man." Said this dictator who oppressed the people in his people place and threw people into hellholes like Lusaka Central Prison. The people of Africa knew nothing about suffering before the gospel arrived. What a blatant liar. And now the British imprisoned Kenneth Koenda in 1955 in Lusaka Central Prison for 9 months. They built Lusaka Central for 80 prisoners. Kenneth Koenda put 1,200 people in a prison that the British had built for 80. When Kenneth Koenda was imprisoned in Lusaka Central, he had a cell to himself. When we were imprisoned there, there were about 60 people in every cell, 15 feet by 25 feet. When the British imprisoned Koenda in Lusaka Central, they had electricity, they had plumbing, they had access to library. He had bed with sheets and desk and table and gramophone in a cell. When we were locked in there, there was no plumbing, no electricity, no cooked meals, aside from one big pot of sadza, which was cooked each day, mealy meal, and that was it. There was no protein, no vegetables, no fruit. It was a disease factory. People were dying because he believes in the goodness of man. Well, according to dear Kenneth Koenda, the people of Africa knew nothing about suffering before the missionaries arrived with the gospel. According to people like Koenda, all Africans lived in peace and harmony and tranquility and prosperity before the missionaries arrived and ruined everything with the gospel. Now, you might expect such ahistoric ramblings from committed Marxist who hate the gospel, but all too many Christians, because of their ignorance of history, repeat these allegations, even in Christian publications, because they're being brainwashed by the world's state indoctrination gulags that are often called schools, and by the Hollywood blasphemy industry, and by a news media, which in many ways is nothing more than propaganda. And so, what was the reality? The reality of heathenism was when Mary Slessor arrived in Calabar, she is horrified to discover that a woman who gave birth to twins was regarded with horror. The belief was that the father of one of the twins has to be an evil spirit, and the mother had been guilty of a great sin to bear twins. And therefore, at least one of the babies was believed to be a monster, and so twins were seized, and their backs were broken, they were crushed into calabash, or water pot, taken out not by the doorway, but by a hole broken in the back wall, which was immediately built up again. They were thrown in the bush to be eaten by insects and by wild beasts like hyenas or vultures. Mary found Calabar in the grip of rampant witchcraft, drunkenness, and immorality, not to mention slavery. She intervened to prevent a witch doctor pouring boiling oil over a woman who has staked out spread eagle on the ground. Cannibalism and slavery between the tribes was widespread. And once, when instructed to heal a dying chief, she knew if she failed to heal him, she'd be blamed for his death. So first she got rid of all the witchcraft charms and the sacrificed chickens lying around the hut, prayed, gave the chief good medicine, nursed him back to health. And the wives of the chief were particularly grateful for Mary's success, because they would have otherwise been killed and buried with the chief if he had died. This is the reality of heathenism. The wives were understandably very keen to learn about the book that had saved their lives. Samuel Marsden, the pioneer missionary to Australia and New Zealand, witnessed the depth of degradation and the hold of superstition of the Maori people when the widow of a deceased chief hanged herself with the approval and applause of parents and brothers. Can you imagine family members standing by encouraging their sister or daughter to commit suicide by hanging herself because her husband had died? Therefore, your life is now worthless, so you must die with him. That was typical in heathen religions. Cannibalism was rife amongst the Maori. One chief declared he had eaten 139 people. Now, they worked this out not because he knew numerics, but because he'd kept one bone from every person he'd ever killed and was laid out there. Count out, he had eaten 139 people. One woman confessed she had killed and eaten 19 children. Missionaries to the New Hebrides found human sacrifice and cannibalism rife throughout the Pacific Islands. In Fiji, 2/3 of all children were boiled and eaten. Every village had a human butcher. Aged parents were butchered and eaten by their own children. Men would even cook their best wife or child as a special feast for their friends. I mean, this just sounds incomprehensible, but this is the reality of what life was like before the gospel arrived. John Patton, missionary to the New Hebrides, reported on an occasion at Tana when three women were killed in a human sacrifice to secure the recovery to health of the chief. When missionary to the South Seas Islands, John Williams was criticized for imposing foreign Christian standards upon unwilling communities living in primitive bliss. He noted that these same communities were societies where laziness, promiscuity, human sacrifice, and the burial alive of infants had shortly before been commonplace. Far from the missionaries interrupting the peace and tranquility of pagan nations, the missionaries came to nations that were passing through immense upheavals. When Hudson Taylor first landed in Shanghai in 1864, China was being torn apart by a vicious civil war called the Taiping Rebellion. Rebels held the city. 50,000 imperial troops besieged it. The house that Hudson was staying in Shanghai was struck by cannon fire. The house next to his was destroyed. He frequently witnessed people being beheaded. He himself came close to being lynched on occasion. 25 million Chinese were killed in two civil wars that raged in the 1850s and 1860s in China. Another 10 million died just between 1877 and 1879 through a famine. in north of China. As Dr. George Grant states in his introduction to The Great Essential of Missions, as missionaries moved out from Christendom to the uttermost parts of the earth, they were shocked to discover all the horrors of untamed heathenism. They found abortion all too prevalent, infanticide all too commonplace, abandonment all too familiar, euthanasia all too customary. They were confronted by the specters of endemic famine, poverty, unfettered disease, widespread chattel slavery, cannibalism, ritual abuse, patricide, that's a killing of parents, human sacrifice, sexual perversity, petty tyranny, paternalistic exploitation, live burials, exterminative clan warfare, genocidal tribal vendettas all predominated. As missionaries circled the globe and penetrated the jungles and crossed the seas, they preached a singular message: light out of darkness, liberty out of tyranny, life out of death, to cultures endemic with terrible poverty and brutality and lawlessness and disease. Those faithful Christian witnesses interjected the novel Christian concepts of grace and charity, law, medicine, and the sanctity of life. They overturned despots, liberated the captives, rescued the perishing. They established hospitals. They founded orphanages. They started rescue missions. They built almshouses, homes for the poor. They opened up soup kitchens. They incorporated charitable societies. They changed laws. They demonstrated love. They lived as if people really mattered. Wherever missionaries went, they faced a dual challenge: confront sin in people's hearts, confront sin in people's cultures. The obstacles, the dangers, and the difficulties that they had to face and overcome were staggering. By an act of British Parliament, missionaries were illegal in India. In China, not only were all missionary activities completely illegal, but so too was attempting to learn the Chinese language. You could get the death penalty for trying to learn the Chinese language or for teaching the Chinese language to foreigners. There was a ban on any Chinese person teaching their language to foreigners. So the Chinese tutors to Robert Morrison, the first Protestant missionary to China, they had to carry poison on their bodies so that if they were discovered, they could quickly end their lives and escape Chinese torture. Because at that time, the Chinese forbade foreign women, Robert Morrison had to live apart from his wife Mary for most of their lives, once they were separated for 6 years. Now, I've heard women complaining that the husband's away for 6 days. 6 weeks they'd consider absolutely horrific, but, you know, 6 years separated for the gospel. America's first foreign missionary, Adoniram Judson, was captured on the high seas and incarcerated in a French prison from which he escaped. Later, he was imprisoned and tortured in death prison in Burma for 18 months, including every night being strung up with feet on a pole tied up so that only his shoulders are resting on the ground. Can imagine a backache this caused. He couldn't even walk after this. David Livingstone wrote to his sisters, "We need to be uncommon Christians, that is, eminently holy and devoted servants of the Most High. Let us seek that selfishness be extirpated, pride banished, unbelief driven from the mind, every idol dethroned, everything hostile to holiness and opposed to the divine will crucified, that holiness to the Lord may be engraved on the heart and evermore characterize our whole conduct." One mission organization wrote to David Livingstone asking, "Have you found a good road to where you are? If so, we want to send other men to join you." Livingstone replied, "If you have men who will come only if they know there's a good road, I don't want them. I want men who will come even if there's no road at all." C.T. Studd, the famous cricket captain turned pioneer missionary, declared, "If Jesus Christ be God, and if he died for me, no sacrifice can be too great for me to make for him." As he suffered malaria and other attacks, C.T. Studd wrote, "Some like to live within sound of church or chapel bell. I want to run a rescue shop within a yard of hell." In the words of C.T. Studd, Christ's call is to capture men from the devil's clutches, to snatch them from the very jaws of hell, to enlist and train them for Jesus and make them a mighty army for God. But This can only be accomplished by red-hot, unconventional, unfettered Holy Spirit religion, by reckless sacrifice and heroism in the foremost trenches. The challenge of David Livingstone rings out to us today. Can that be called a sacrifice, which is simply paid back as a small part of a great debt owing to our God, which we can never repay? It is emphatically no sacrifice. Say rather, privilege. Studying the sacrifices and the exploits of the pioneer missionaries of the 19th century is most challenging and inspiring. These were ordinary people, made extraordinary by dynamic and vibrant Christian faith, which carried them through some of the worst circumstances imaginable. C.T. Studd testified, "I once had another religion, hunting the Bible for hidden truths, but no obedience, no sacrifice. Then came the change. The real thing came before me. Words became deeds. The commands of Christ became not merely Sunday recitations, but battle calls to be obeyed. Assent to creed was born again into decisive action of obedience." Hudson Taylor stated that his life was based upon three facts. There is a living God. He has spoken in the Bible. He means what he says, and he will do all that he has promised. Hudson Taylor wrote of the intense longing for God that gripped him, of a conviction that never left him that he was called to China. Hudson Taylor agonized in prayer for China. Sometimes he prayed through the night. He wrote of wrestling with his unbelief and how the Lord conquered my unbelief, and I surrendered myself to God for this service. The Great Commission is not an option to be considered. It is a command to be obeyed, he said. At the end of his long life, Hudson Taylor could declare that the sun had never risen upon him in China without finding him at prayer. Wow. How many people could say something like that? The sun has never risen without finding him at prayer. The battle is the Lord's, he wrote, and he will conquer. We may fail. We do fail continually. But he never fails. The pioneer missionaries of the 19th century were inspired by a most positive and optimistic faith. They were absolutely convinced that the Lord, who gave the Great Commission, would ensure that it would be fulfilled. The will of God will never lead you where the grace of God cannot keep you. When after 7 years of laboring in China, Robert Morrison saw the first Chinese convert, he wrote, "May he be the first fruits of a great harvest of millions who shall believe and be saved." Now, he had waited for 7 years for one convert. You would have thought he could be discouraged. But he could see in faith ahead that millions would be saved. In fact, today we know there's at least 120 million Christians in China now. Phenomenal. Scotland's first foreign missionary, Alexander Duff, declared, "Oh, what promises are ours, if we only had faith to grasp them. What a promise is that in the Great Commission, go and make disciples of all nations. And lo, I am with you, even to the end of the world. We go forth. Amongst the hundreds of millions of the nations, we find gigantic systems of idolatry and superstition consolidated for thousands of years. They tower as high mountains. But what does faith say? Believe, and it will be. And if any church on earth will realize that faith, to that church will the honor belong of evangelizing the nations and bringing down the mountains." When after 7 years, labor in India, William Carey was able to witness their first convert, Krishna Pal from Hinduism, Carey declared, "The divine grace which changed one Indian's heart could obviously change 100,000. Carey declared, "The work to which God has set his hands will infallibly prosper. We only want men and money to fill this country with the knowledge of Christ. We are neither working at uncertainty nor afraid for the results. Christ must reign until Satan has not 1 inch of territory. God's cause will triumph." In the words of William Carey's historic sermon, which launched the modern missionary movement, "Expect great things from God, attempt great things for God." By God's grace, William Carey was able to successfully campaign against the Hindu practice of suti, where the widows were burned alive on the funeral pyre of their deceased husbands. Carey also ended the practice of burning lepers alive. William Carey established the first newspaper ever printed in Oriental language. He introduced the steam engine to India. He pioneered lending libraries, introduced savings banks. Why savings banks? So that poor people could own their own home. He pioneered forest conservation. 50 years before the British government got into forestry conservation, William Carey was pioneering forestry conservation. Man, way ahead of his time. He is advocating a missions conference 100 years before the First World Missions Conference. He is advocating Cape Town as a site for World Missions Conference 200 years before we had that one in 2010. He established the first Christian college in Asia, which is still training leaders. And he succeeded in producing and distributing over 200,000 Bibles, New Testaments, and Gospels in 36 languages, in addition to many books and tracts. There never was a more productive Bible translator than William Carey. By God's grace, through the ministry of Mary Slessor, the killing of twins ceased. Slave trading in Calabar was eradicated. Drunkenness, killing, witchcraft diminished. Many schools and churches were established, and most of the people of Calabar came to embrace the gospel of Christ. The first public worship service in New Zealand was conducted on Christmas Day, 1814, by Samuel Marsden. By 1845, it was reported that 98% of the previous cannibal tribe of the Maoris had embraced Christianity. By the time John Williams was clubbed to death by cannibals on the island of Eremonga in 1839, he had succeeded in transforming scores of islands by the scriptures he had translated, by the schools he had established, by the churches he had built, and many thousands of islanders had come to faith in Christ. John Williams had been converted 25 years earlier by a sermon based on "What is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? What shall a man give in exchange for his soul?" True to that verse that he'd heard on that night of his conversion, 1814, John Williams found his life by losing it for Christ. By the way, he was commissioned as a missionary of London Missionary Society at the very same service when Robert Moffat was commissioned, who came out to Northern Cape, to Kuruman. Frank Patton followed in his father John Patton's footsteps and became a missionary to the island where his father had been forced to flee for his life 34 years before. During his ministry there, he was blessed to see the whole population of Tana won for Christ. It was said, before he came, there were no Christians. When he left, there were no heathen. What an epitaph. Similarly, Robert Morrison had the joy of seeing his son, John Morrison, follow in his footsteps and pour his heart and soul into the work of bringing the gospel to the people of China. All of Adoniram Judson's 5 surviving children, he had 10 children, only 5 survived childhood, but those 5 grew up to distinguish themselves in Christian service. Robert Moffat, who produced the first translation, the first complete translation of an African language into the Bible, had the joy of seeing 5 of his 7 children actively involved in missionary service. His son, John Moffat, established the first mission station amongst the Maribili in Bulawayo, where I was brought up. 2 of C.T. Studd's daughters, who had been born in China, came out and joined him with their husbands in his Heart of Africa mission in the Congo. One of the many fruits of William Wilberforce's lifelong crusade against the slave trade was that Samuel Ajay Crowther, who had been born in Yorubaland in 1807, the year that Great Britain abolished the slave trade, became the first African bishop of the Church of England. Samuel Crowther had been born in Yorubaland, what today is Nigeria. He is captured at age 13 by African slave traders, sold to a Portuguese slave trader for transport across the Atlantic. Samuel was rescued by a British naval squadron in 1822, put ashore at Freetown. From 1809, the British government had mobilized its navy to search suspected slave ships, even foreign vessels on the high seas. And for a century, the Royal Navy was dedicated to setting the captives free, going far beyond clearing the oceans of slave ships. They boldly sailed up uncharted rivers and creeks to storm slave stockades, freeing captives at every turn. Here's a picture of slaves rescued off a ship just off Zanzibar, off the east coast of Africa. Great Britain dedicated its resources to fighting and opposing the slave trade, unprecedented in the history of nations. The British spent millions of pounds in suppressing the slave trade and sacrificed much blood in fighting to set the captives free, which was the primary mission of the Royal Navy in the 19th century. The West African country of Sierra Leone was established by British evangelicals like William Wilberforce as a haven for freed slaves. And so Britain invested vast amount of money into developing Sierra Leone as a free and independent state where liberated slaves could settle. In Sierra Leone, Crowther was converted to Christ, and he received an education first in Sierra Leone, later in England. About the third year of my liberation from the slavery of man, I was convinced of another worse state of slavery, that of sin and Satan. I was admitted into the visible Church of Christ here on earth as a soldier to fight manfully under his banner against spiritual enemies. In 1843, Samuel was ordained as a Church of England minister for service with the Church Missionary Society, the CMS. Samuel Crowther was one of the leaders of a successful missionary endeavor that took him and several other former slaves back to their native Yoruba land, where a vigorous Christianity soon developed. One of the first converts that Samuel baptized was his own mother, who took the Christian name Hannah, received from the Lord, given back to the Lord. His language, Yoruba, became the first African language to be used for the Church of England liturgy and worship, and he did the translation. Yoruba Christian worship was distinctly Protestant and evangelical in the Church of England style. Crowther led converts in burying or destroying traditional charms, fetishes, and idols. In 1864, Samuel Ajay Crowther was ordained as the first African bishop of the Church of England in the overflowing Canterbury Cathedral. And he was directed to undertake a mission along the Niger River to follow up on the Niger expedition of 1841, which was led by William Wilberforce's successor, T. Foxwell Buxton. Buxton was an evangelical leader in Parliament and an anti-slavery crusader. His expedition up the Niger River Valley of West Africa was to overcome the ravages of the slave industry entrenched there. Of the 145 Europeans on expedition, 130 were struck down with malaria and 40 died. Imagine one mission where 40 die. Yet the expedition was successful in establishing a missionary center at Fora Bay for training liberated slaves to evangelize West Africa, built on the very place where the slave market had once stood. The rafters of the roof were made almost entirely from the masts of old slave ships, donated by the Royal Navy for this purpose. Samuel Crowther was one of the first four students to be graduated from Fora Bay College, which became sub-Saharan Africa's first university. Samuel labored diligently to bring the gospel to the diverse tribes along the Niger River, producing biblical tracts and scripture texts dealing with witchcraft and charms. I took this picture of the man who's curator of the museum, which is in Samuel Crowther's house, which is the first double-story building built in Nigeria, showing the Bible and the Church of England prayer book, which Samuel Crowther translated. He dealt with common ground between the Quran and the scriptures and produced gospel presentations for Muslims founded entirely on biblical quotations. Samuel Crowther wrote in 1854 of his contact with King Ogara of Punda, "I asked if he'd like his people to be taught God's book and how to worship God as we do in the white man's country. For it was these two things together which made England great, and that they would bring peace and prosperity to any country that received and embraced them." The king replied that he was very desirous that wars should cease and that his people might trade and be taught God's book, and he wished us many blessings. So Samuel was effective in opposing slavery, witchcraft, and Islam, and he won many converts amongst the Noop and the Hausa people. The Hausa people are traditionally Muslim. Bishop Crowther worked effectively at indigenizing an evangelical Anglicanism, which is truly African. Today, there are 18 million Anglicans in Nigeria. That's 18 times more Anglicans in Nigeria than on the whole of the British Isles and North Africa gathering for church every Sunday. Isn't that an extraordinary achievement? Missions is the lifeblood of the church. And it's absolutely essential that our congregations and our families be presented with these and many other inspiring examples of those whom God has blessed in such extraordinary ways. We need to read these examples. We need to feed our minds and our souls with examples of excellence. I pray that these few selected adventures and sacrifices and exploits, pictures and achievements present will whet your appetite to read the Great Essential Missions and to obtain more missionary biographies, to start the lifelong habit of making time to feed your mind and soul with what has been described as the noblest object that can engage the enthusiasm of man, the salvation of millions. May God be pleased to use the Great Essential Missions to inspire a new generation of missionaries to expect great things from God and to attempt great things for God. One of the people who answered this call was David Brainerd, missionary to Indians, whose journal included this prayer: "Here I am. Send me. Send me to the rough, to the savage pagans of the wilderness. Send me from all that is called comfort on earth. Send me even to death itself, if it be but in thy service and to promote thy kingdom." You only have one life, it'll soon be passed. Only what's done for Jesus Christ will last. Any questions, any comments on the greatest century of missions?
What's Andrew? The position now in Sierra Leone?
Situation in Sierra Leone, right now, they've gone through some very, very hard times. It's one of the places of blood diamonds, and there's been some hideous gangster-type wars fought there. Such a pity, because their capital, Freetown, it's had such a good evangelical funding. Liberia is similar, where the Americans founded Liberia with the capital of Monrovia, named after the American president who founded it, to resettle black slaves who had been set free. And so Liberia and Sierra Leone, who both were specifically created as free states, and at this moment they really need the gospel and revival, because I think that while there's a lot of nominal Christianity, the wicked have seized control of those countries. Other comments, Jonathan? Eagle's Nest is sent from a container. Wow. When we say a container, we talk about a 20-foot, 18-ton sort of gospel literature container. That's good to know. Yes, let's keep praying for Sierra Leone. I mean, they had a good start, a very good start. Sierra Leone must be won back to Christ. Other comments, observations, questions? Yes. I think that's a very important point to make. In fact, David Noble makes that point in Understand the Times as well, that all the communist mass-murdering dictators, whether you're talking about Pol Pot, whoever they are, every one of them are products of Western universities that have been hijacked by secular humanism. And in fact, it's an amazing thing that all of these Marxist dictators, the whole bunch of them, they're products of universities. They're not uneducated, simple people, as they like to speak, like you think that they are of the people. They're not. They're intellectual elite who are the products of university brainwashing, and they come back. The man who killed 40% of Cambodia, Pol Pot, he is product of Sorbonne University from Paris, and came back there, started the Khmer Rouge, and slaughtered all the intelligentsia even school teachers, someone wearing glasses. That was enough to get them killed in Cambodia. But he himself was an intellectual elite from the university. It's absolutely bizarre. Charles Taylor, this mass murderer who's wrecked Liberia, he's an American. He came out there, university education and so on, and he comes not to liberate the people, to oppress them, turn into a gangster state. It's so much that Robert Mugabe, I mean, he's a product of Fort Hare University, and you could carry on. There's none of these mass murdering dictators, whichever ones you want to look at, all the communist leaders, they're all products of universities. And this is something that was brought to my attention by David Noble, who wrote Understand the Times, that's why it's so important to have university ministries. We need to bring the universities back to Christ. We need to win the campuses for Christ. Because on the campuses are being raised future leaders, but in many cases, bad leaders, because the ideology in the universities, evolutionism, situation ethics, Marxism, and all the other nonsense, which is going to produce tyrants, not civil servants who are dedicated to serving God and their neighbor. Super important that we get back to education and reclaim the campuses for Christ. Yes, indeed. Sadly, as has been pointed out in the Shackled Continent by the British economist Guest, that Africa is poor because Africa is not free, because their leaders, in many cases, are in fact slaves of Marxism, which has only wrecked countries wherever they've gone. So we would be more prosperous if we were more free. And what we need are leaders who respect God and respect the word of God and respect biblical principles for all areas of life. But if people are going to try situation ethics and Marxist evolutionary theories and economics, it's a guaranteed pathway to disaster and catastrophe and bankruptcy. Other comments, observations? Yes. I doubt it. In fact, I think they're all embarrassed about their missionaries. So while India would produce a centenary, a bicentenary postage stamp of William Carey coming to India, in Britain, they just ignored him totally. Britain would put Charles Darwin on their pound notes in commemoration of him, but nothing on Livingston, for the Livingston 200, nothing for Carey and so on. Just amazing. Scotland so despises its own Christian heritage, they put a parking lot over the burial ground of John Knox, the great Scottish reformer. Now, the only way you can find the grave of John Knox is in a parking lot. They've got some little brick or something that says, you know, John Knox's grave's on there. Literally put a parking lot over the burial ground. Can you imagine? So the Western nations are not just embarrassed, they despise and hate, I think in many cases, the great Christians who made them great. When I went to Geneva for the Calvin 500, now this is 2009, 500th anniversary of the birth of John Calvin, arguably one of the greatest reformers and theologians of all time. We get to Geneva at the 500th anniversary, and what have they done? You can't get to the Geneva Wall, the greatest Reformation monument in the world. It's a huge wall honoring everyone from Zwingli, Luther, all the way, Calvin, Knox, this massive monument. They put a scaffolding in front of the whole thing to have a rock concert, coinciding with the very month that, you know, here we've got people from around the world, from South Korea, Canada, Australia, South Africa, America, all coming to Geneva to honor Calvin, and the Reformation Wall is taken over by a rock concert. That's not coincidental. Fortunately, we had the church to use, and Calvin's Order 12 for our daily lectures at the Academy. But the Reformation Monument, they had to choose the 500th anniversary of John Calvin to obscure the whole thing. We couldn't even get to it. So I've been there many a time, but my wife couldn't see the wall because you couldn't even get there. Completely obliterated by a scaffolding grandstand for this rock concert over it. Now, that's the way the average European municipality and government thinks of the reformers and the missionaries of the past. Whereas, when I went to Livingston in Zambia for the 200th anniversary of David Livingstone's birth, the mayor's office was there to welcome, the Zambian National TV. I mean, it was just, there was respect from the top down. They were printing from Malawi and from Zambia special commemorative stamps commemorating David Livingstone. So this is the thing. They're respected in Africa and Asia, but they're not respected in Europe. Absolutely shocking.